Hello, and welcome to Medic in the Middle. Hello, and welcome back to Medic in the Middle. Medic in the Middle is a podcast exploring a range of different topics, issues, and articles. The podcast features a range of different pre-hospital and in-hospital specialties. In this episode, we are really lucky to speak to Yorkshire Heart CCP Jonathan Bush. In this episode, we talk about drownings, covering things such as the initial scene management, the pathophysiology of drownings, and management and special considerations to take into account when dealing with a patient who has drowned. So without further ado, let's delve into this episode. Yeah, so you finished pretty late then, 1 o'clock.
Yeah, and then I slept through till 10 and then a bit of admin to square away, and then putting some thoughts together, obviously for today.
Yeah, have you got a night shift tonight?
No, I'm good now. I'm not back until Monday, so I've got a rare weekend off.
That's good. Okay, cool. Well, I was thinking about starting off with, like, do you want to just tell us a little bit about your role and like what your daily role entails and what it is that you do exactly?
Yeah, that's absolutely fine. So my name's Jonathan Bush, or Johnny, everyone calls me. And I am a critical care paramedic with the Yorkshire Hazards Area Response Team. So it's a fairly new role. And the aim is that whilst I work for Heart, the clinical aspect of my career, so as a specialist paramedic in critical care, is managed by the Trust's critical care network and sort of the leadership around that. So my job is completely interchangeable with the role that our land-based critical care paramedics deliver, and also, for example, Yorkshire Air Ambulance as well. So we're all completely interchangeable. The job's the same. We're led by the same sort of clinical leadership. We socialise together, train together. We just work in different parts of the trust. So it's a really, really exciting role. It's broke down barriers between those sort of different departments, really, and from a networking point of view, we can all lean into each other and sort of learn from each other, do joint training, sort of joint governance days and things like that. So it's a really, really exciting role, and we're really, really lucky to have it.
I was going to say, it must be quite, it's quite good, isn't it, to bring that critical care aspect to a heart environment. So they do need kind of enhanced care in those sort of more hazardous places. You're able to provide that?
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, in Yorkshire, we're really, really lucky that all of our heart paramedics have got quite a generous extended scope of practice anyway, not too dissimilar to the critical care sort of scope of practice. So a big part of my role is facilitating the education, governance, clinical supervision for heart paramedics practicing those extended skills. And then for the rare occasion where the patient just needs a little bit more input than what our heart paramedics can deliver, then we're there for that as well. But a big part of it is decision making, deciding to sort of not do things, and sort of optimizing patient flow, getting them to definitive care quickly, knowing what matters and what doesn't matter with regards to clinical interventions, and when these extended interventions actually start to hinder patient progress to definitive care. It's strange, actually, a lot of decision making around not doing things.
Oh man, that's awesome. It sounds like a great role. Sounds really good. So I suppose we better kind of zoom in on what it is we're going to talk about today then. So drownings it is, and obviously I really appreciate you kind of coming on, well, to have a chat with us about it, because you know, you can bring your area of kind of hazardous area response team expertise to it, and the critical care stuff as well. Thought we'd just start with a definition. It's always good to start with a definition, isn't it? So, I mean, exact definitions of drownings have varied quite widely over the years, and the definitions do seem to have kind of interchanged a little bit. And more recently, we've kind of moved away from terms like wet drowning, dry drowning, near drowning, secondary drowning. They've all kind of been now framed as more kind of historical references, and we're moving more to a place now where drowning simply refers to the process resulting in primary respiratory impairment from submersion or immersion in a liquid medium. So the person is prevented from breathing and gaseous exchanges is impaired due to a liquid medium at the entrance of the airway. And drowning doesn't always have to infer that the patient has died as such.
Yeah, and I think that's so important. Regardless of where we practice in the UK, from a pre-hospital point of view, very, very few of us see this very often in our practice. And the opportunity to overcomplicate it, I think, is really there if we start getting sort of tied up in what type of drowning it is, what kind of water we've found the patient in, etc. So anything to remove sort of any mud from the water, so to speak, so we can just actually crack on with actually just correcting what's killing the patient or what's caused that patient's cardiac arrest, and sort of not worrying too much about all these other definitions, I think is really, really helpful.
Absolutely, yeah. And the World Health Organization put some kind of facts out there about general statistics around drownings, and I didn't really appreciate before preparing for this podcast today just how much of an issue it is, really, kind of more in, not necessarily just in the UK, but more like worldwide. So 372,000 people die every year from drowning. Globally, over half of all drowning deaths are under 25 years old, so they're going to be that younger cohort of patients. There are approximately 42 drownings deaths every hour of every day, but this is worldwide, bear in mind, not UK. Males are twice as likely to drown in comparison to females. And alcohol use around water is one of the most substantial risk factors for drowning in most countries, especially for adolescents and adults. And it remains one of the 10 leading causes of death for people young people aged 1 to 25 years old worldwide.
Yeah, and I think that's certainly reflective in my own practice. For the years that I've worked with HEART, the vast majority of the drownings that I've been to have been children with a not insignificant sort of amount of young adults as well. But the vast majority have been sort of teenagers and younger jumping into sort of bodies of water.
In terms of like causes from that, as have you seen, like experientially in your practice, as you said, children, but have you seen other factors that have been involved as part of that kind of drowning etiology, such as like that alcohol or drug use, or it's quite rare you'll find people have medical events, isn't it, in terms of drowning? It tends to be a little bit more external factors like drugs, alcohol, mental health, suicide.
So mental health, suicide is one of my more common sort of experiences of practice, but with children in particular, it's just a lack of education and understanding about sort of how dangerous water is. And I know we'll come on to that in a little while, but it's jumping into water and not really appreciating, even in the height of summer, the effect of that sudden immersion in cold water and some of the reflexes that it can initiate, even in just sort of completely still water, really. But I think you've touched on a really interesting point, and that is remembering to, yes, the patient has drowned, but why have they drowned? You know, often it is they've sort of come across complications in the water, but actually, is there a traumatic or medical cause that's precipitated it? Like you said, is it drugs or alcohol? Was it intentional? It's sort of a patient of two halves, really. You've got the drowning, but then also why did they end up in the water in the first place? And is there any traumatic injuries that explain sort of maybe post-ROPS, some of the physiological derangement that we see?
Yeah, absolutely. I did a bit of reading around this. I looked at a few different sources, Arkem being one of them, and they kind of split it down into two groups. So you've got the primary event or the secondary event. So that in terms of etiology, drownings, they split it into two. So it can either be primary drowning or the event can be secondary too. And their list is, you know, seizures. You alluded to it just about head or trauma, head or spinal traumas. Cardiac arrhythmias, another one. Hypothermia, alcohol or drug ingestion, as we've mentioned. Syncope, apnea, hyperventilation, suicidal mental health problems and hypoglycemia, but it does kind of note that the causes tend to vary with the person's age and the environment that they're in, really, as well. You know, where you know, where I'm based in the Midlands, obviously, it says it in the name, we're not generally exposed to vast open bodies of water in great sort of instances, really. We're not coastal, so a lot of the drownings that we'll see in the area that I work will tend to be rivers, canals, lakes. And again, you're going to have a particular kind of cohort of people in those areas. We don't see a lot of coastal drownings, obviously, just because of the geography of where we work.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because often these inland bodies of water, they're actually colder than the ocean anyway. So when we start, I'm sure we'll talk about it shortly, but when we start talking about deciding whether the patient's being rapidly immersed in icy cold water, actually it's these inland water temperatures where we see the colder sort of temperatures anyway, inland water, sorry, where we see the colder temperatures when compared to the ocean. I'm much like yourself, because I work in Yorkshire, we do have a coast. But statistically, most of our drownings occur inland in those canals, those rivers, like I said, those lakes and reservoirs.
Yeah, absolutely. Should we talk about the mechanism of drowning? I think that's like quite a good place to start. I was lucky enough to go to the trauma care conference recently in Birmingham.
Yes,
and listen to a talk at trauma care that was on. The name of the chap, what was it now? Dr. Paddy Morgan, that was him.
Yes,
spoken to him prior to this podcast, so if he does end up listening, hello, Paddy. and he was kind of doing a talk about drownings as a whole, but he mentioned the processes of drowning as a mechanism. So when the patient first hits the water, they have that cold shock reflex almost, so they have that involuntary gasp or hyperventilation, tachycardia, and almost involuntary panic movements going on. So they'll be breathing very quickly, their heart rate will be quite elevated, and they'll have that natural kind of fight or flight response. So during that process, there is that initial aspiration of water into the hypopharynx. From there, the patient will experience laryngospasm. And then from there, it'll kind of split off into two then, really. We'll see either dry or wet. So if it is, I mean, not up to about 90% of patients, they are wet drowning. So the water will enter the lungs, impair gaseous exchange. And from there, you'll get sort of cerebral hypoxia, acidosis, and eventually cardiac arrest, leading to all them secondary problems then we're going to see, like brain injuries and brain tissue death. From the laryngospasm, if the other portion of that, that's the other kind of 10% that we'll see, which is the quite rare bracket, is the dry drownings, and that's where the laryngospasm doesn't relax, basically, after the patient has gone unconscious. So there'll be a kind of more minimal amount of water actually in the lungs, but they'll die of that hypoxia, and they'll still get that secondary brain injury to the acidosis, and they'll still go into cardiac arrest, but it'll just be a slightly different mechanism. I don't know what your thoughts are on that and kind of experience with that are.
Yeah, so I think I always like to, in my head, keep the sort of pathophysiology around drowning as simple as possible. And I always just think, you know, your water, the water enters your lungs, and it doesn't actually need that much water to sort of cause fatal consequences, really. Aspiration of around sort of 1 to 3 mil per kilogram is all it really needs. So water enters your lungs, and that causes this surfactant washout. And if we sort of remember back to sort of our sort of basic anatomy and physiology for the respiratory system, that surfactant is what stops your alveolar collapsing or sticking together once there's no air in there. So that's the presence of that surfactant is what allows your alveoli to expand. So we've had that washout caused by the water, and actually that's what produces a lot of the foamy sort of bubbles that we see coming out of the airway when we start ventilating these patients when they first come out of the water. And this alveolar collapse means that when blood gets to the alveoli and would normally deposit carbon dioxide and other sort of waste products from cellular metabolism, and it would normally collect fresh oxygen and then move that fresh oxygen around the body. Well, that's not happening anymore, either at all or not as efficiently, depending on how much water's in the lungs. So what we've got is essentially the blood's coming round to the alveoli to get rid of its carbon dioxide, collect that oxygen, and then move the oxygen around the body. Instead, now it's just getting there with full of carbon dioxide, not able to get rid of it, and we're just taking it back into the circulatory sort of into wider circulation, and that leads to an acidosis. As we become more acidotic, so our pH drops and that CO2 level rises, often that's actually what causes that involuntary gasp when somebody's trying to hold their breath, for example, underwater. Your body just wants to get rid of that carbon dioxide, so it eventually forces you to take that breath. So yes, I like to think of drowning that way, really, from a sort of patho point of view.
You mentioned about the surfactant washout of the alveoli, and I suppose whilst we're on that point, it might be good to just touch on the, and we talked about it a little bit earlier in terms of fresh water drownings and salt water drownings with the geographical areas that we work in. I suppose you're in Yorkshire, aren't you? And I'm in the Midlands. So we're kind of more likely to see, as you say, fresh bodies of water, and more of our patients are going to be fresh water drownings than salt water drownings. You mentioned about the surfactant washout, and I suppose that's going to be more common, isn't it, with fresh water drownings?
That's right, yeah. Whereas, with salt water, I mean, like, touch wood, it's not something that I see too much in my practice. But with salt water, what we get instead is that osmotic shift. So we've got that hypertonic solution in our lungs, essentially, and we're going to then start shunting fluid into the lungs because of that hyperosmolar sort of shift.
Yeah, so I suppose it's just the difference between that hypotonic and the hyperosmolar concentrations of salt water and fresh water.
That's right, yeah. But it's really, really good, like you said, in that the sort of consensus now is that we just, we don't, pre-hospitally, we don't treat them any differently. It's still a ventilation problem when we're resuscitating these patients. It certainly becomes more of a consideration for the patients that have taken on some sort of salt water, maybe post-ROSC in hospital, and the sort of coming days and weeks of their treatment, because we're going to start to get derangement of sort of a metabolic level because of that, and that'll need treatment in the hospital phase for these patients.
That's it. So I suppose it's good to know, it's nice to know, but ultimately, management wise, pre-hospitally for us, salt water or fresh water, that just to kind of clarify, there's no difference in the initial pre-hospital management of the patient who has experienced a drowning event.
Absolutely.
Okay, cool. Shall we talk a little bit about the cardiovascular side of it? We touched a little bit now on the respiratory side of things with alveolar collapse and the differences between, we're going to see with fresh water and salt water, and that hypoxia, and as you said, about 1 to 3 mils of inhaled aspirated fluids is such a small amount, isn't it, really? 1 to 3 mils per kilogram.
Absolutely.
I mean, I'm 90 kilograms, for example, so that's, talking less than 100 mils to cause a severe impaired gaseous exchange and VQ mismatch or a ventilation perfusion mismatch. It's just such a small amount, isn't it? And I don't think we really appreciate just how much damage a small amount of water can do to the respiratory system.
Absolutely.
I digress. So cardiovascular effects of drowning events. I don't know whether you want to kick us off, or I've got some notes kind of preformed on this as well.
I mean, so from a cardiovascular point of view, if we've got that cardiovascular collapse and that patient in cardiac arrest, then it's primarily driven by that hypoxia. That's assuming that the person didn't have some sort of cardiac event that led to them sort of being in the water in the first place. So assuming that's not the case, then what we get is that widespread hypoxia. And we know that oxygen is the fuel source for all of our cells. And as that starts to affect the heart, we're going to start to see arrhythmias and eventually cardiac arrest as that heart muscle starts to become hypoxic and dies. We can also get hypovolemia. So hypovolemia can be from a few different sources. It could be from, like, again, always thinking about why the person ended up in the water, some sort of traumatic cause for why that person ended up there in the first place. But we can also get a little bit of fluid shift, which, again, is more pronounced in saltwater drownings. And then we've got this hydrostatic squeeze, where, again, blood starts to pull both with gravity and with due to a pressure gradient with the body being under the water, that when we get the person out of the water, suddenly we take that gravity and that pressure out of the equation. We can then suddenly have a sort of cardiovascular collapse as well.
I was going to say, it's we were taught in the management of, well, JR Count mentions it as well, doesn't it? But if you are, and we'll talk about the processes of the rescue sort of shortly, I suppose, but make sure you're taking out the patient from the water, if possible, at a horizontal level to avoid, like, as you say, those factors like the hydrostatic squeeze, and gravity.
It's quite a mouthful, isn't it?
Yeah, hydrostatic squeeze, yeah. And the gravity having that effect on that, on kind of further worsening that hypovolemia and fluid loss, so you're going to get those shifts. I wanted to kind of quickly touch on, I'm not going to kind of go to town on it because I think it's a podcast in its own right as well, but just those, Paddy Morgan at the Trauma Care Conference talked about the autonomic conflict you can get and just those mechanisms that we can see when we're entering the water. And it's quite interesting. We can get essentially huge cardiovascular arrhythmia issues and QT issues and all the differences in the electrolytes, and you can end up, the patient can end up experiencing basically long QT syndromes, ventricular tachycardias, and that kind of catecholaminergic surge, basically, of adrenaline dump that they get when they hit the water. You get that cold shock response, which is essentially sympathetically mediated tachycardias, that hyperventilation that we talked about, and peripheral vasoconstriction and hypertension. You can experience that as a kind of like the initial cold shock response from hitting the water. But some people may also experience, I'm sure you've heard of that, the mammalian diving reflex response as well. So the diving response is more of a parasympathetic mediated event. So you get sort of profound sinus bradycardia. You can experience peripheral vasoconstriction, I want to say. I think it's peripheral vasoconstriction.
Yes, it is, yeah. Yeah. We start to get a shunt of sort of perfusion. We shunt perfusion to the critical organs, the centre of the body, so you start to get that peripheral vasoconstriction.
Yeah, and essentially, if both of these events are triggered at the same time and you have that parasympathetic and the sympathetic response happening at the same time, you can get something called an autonomic conflict, which is essentially where you're triggering both of the sympathetic and the parasympathetic nervous system, which can lead, as I said, to cardiac arrhythmias, which may... There's a paper by Shattuck et al. They wrote this in 2012, and they were kind of hinting at the fact that there may be some drownings that are not classically fitting within the mechanism that we've spoke about, and it might actually be a cardiovascular event that they're experiencing. Obviously, this is quite hard for them to prove, because a lot of the post-mortems can be quite difficult in these patients anyway, but it's interesting to bear in mind, isn't it, that like some of these patients, I suppose, from a bit of a geeky perspective, might actually have a cardiovascular event that will cause them to go into cardiac arrest prior to the actual drowning mechanisms that we've talked about. I just thought that was quite a cool little nugget and probably something for listeners to go away and do a bit of reading in their own time. But I just thought it was a cool little chunk of info to pop in the show.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's move on, because you're obviously the expert on the hazardous area environment management. And I think we spoke about this a little bit kind of off mic as well, over messaging, and kind of just making sure that we emphasise the importance of safety and safety to the rescuer first, and the kind of way we're going to approach and manage these cases, because they're going to be high pressure, high cognitive load environments, aren't they? And I think we just need to make sure that...
Absolutely.
And they're rare as well, in certainly like outside of a heart team kind of environment as well. To an ambulance clinician, there's something that I suppose we're going to be coming across maybe a few times in our career, if that. So having a good structure to the process is just going to be very helpful and take off that extra cognitive load at these scenes, isn't it? Do you want to kind of kickstart us off with a few points that you've learned over the years of working in a heart team to deal with these cases?
By all means, I think it's absolutely critical that we talk about safety, because actually, you know, every OSCE that we do, you know, at first aid, everything starts with that word danger, doesn't it? And in an OSCE, that's where we walk into a room and you sort of give it the jazz hands and say, I'm checking for danger, I'm sort of checking for lions and tigers. And then we crack on with our primary survey. Well, like, we do need to sort of be a little bit more cognizant of that rather than just it being a word that we say. And I think water in particular is so dangerous. I remember before I joined Heart, I had very, very little experience of working on open water. In fact, the first time I ever swam on open water was for my part of my selection process to join the team. I then sort of went away and you do your swift water rescue technician course. And the first thing it taught me, I mean, at the end of it, you're jumping into white water sort of river conditions with real hazards, real danger, even though it's training. You feel like you should come away from that with bags of confidence and think, oh, I'll jump into any water anytime. It did the absolute opposite for me. And I know it's the same for most of my colleagues. It did nothing but prove how dangerous water is, both in a training and live environment. And if anything, it means that for me, committing into the water for a rescue will be the absolute last resort. And there are some steps that we take, like a progressive level of intervention that we take before we make that decision to commit ourselves into water, because it is so, so dangerous, even with all the equipment that we wear. So there's little things like rivers that, you know, on the surface, if you're seeing something that looks like a sort of gnarly white water sort of condition river that you'd expect people to be going down on a giant raft, then it's very easy to look at that and have that sort of that sort of chimp brain activate and say, I'm definitely not going in that water. You know, that's dangerous. I don't need to know much about water to know that I'm probably going to drown if I go into it. But sometimes it can be really, really deceptive. It can look quite calm, apart from when you see a bit of turbulence around some rocks, for example. And you might think, you know what, I could have a go in that. Often that flow is really deceptive and the water is much stronger than you realize. And then there's also the risk of undercurrents. So again, quite a sort of placid looking surface of the water, but the undercurrent can be significantly stronger that can sort of grab hold of you and keep hold of you. There's lots and lots of other risks on the water as well in terms of weirs, and you get some weirs that will retain you. So they will just keep you in there and they'll keep washing you round and round again. And essentially your body's stuck in there until the water levels drop a little bit and it eventually spits you out, which potentially might be a few days. So there's lots and lots of things about, there's loads of other things as well with water, but the point is that it's very, very dangerous. And like I said, if anything, it taught me to not go in water unless I absolutely had to. We've had incidents in my own area of practice sort of over the years where we've had either bystanders or even other responders from a 999 point of view enter the water and then become victims themselves. And instead of having sort of one patient, we've now got four patients that need to be rescued before we can get to the patient that was actually there to get. So it is really, really dangerous. So what we do is when we arrive on scene, we try and zone it out a little bit. So everyone sort of working in the ambulance sector or any of the other emergency services in the UK will be familiar with hot, warm and cold zoning. And we obviously do this at fires and chemical events and like firearms incidents and things like that. But with the water, we define the hot zone as being the water itself. And by being hot, that means that we're not going to commit staff into the water unless they're appropriately trained and wearing the right PPE. And that brings an interesting discussion around our colleagues in the fire rescue service. Not all firefighters are trained to enter the water, or enter moving water, should I say. All firefighters are trained to work sort of bankside safe, like on the bankside safely, and sort of throw lines and sort of rescue from the shore, and maybe enter completely sort of still water where there's no other sort of water responders on scene yet. But they will not enter moving water. Most fire brigades only have a small number of what we call swift water rescue technicians teams, or SRT teams. So you can tip up to an incident and see a lot of sort of firefighters wearing sort of life jackets and what looks like water kit, but they might not be capable to, or, you know, to say, capable of safely entering sort of rapidly moving water. So it's good to know that, yeah, there's different levels of water response that turn out to these jobs, and sort of mountain rescue hearts and the fire service have got the capability, if we need to move into to deploy into moving water. Next, we look at the warm zone. So the warm zone is, we say, 3 meters from the water's edge. Now, that 3 meters is three meters on under ideal circumstances. So if you can imagine a canal or something like that, but actually, particularly with rivers and things like that, if they've been in flood for a while, you might have eroded weak banks that, even if you're zooming within 3 meters, actually there's a chance that the embankment might give way a bit, for example. So we try to say 3 meters from the water's edge, but it can be a little bit further than that. And what we say about the warm zone is, as with any other warm zone, if you absolutely need to be in that warm zone for whatever reason, then we'll put you in there, but with some PPE. And what that normally looks like is a life jacket and all your heart teams and firefighters, or fire appliances, will carry life jackets. So these are different to the PFDs that you'll see water rescue technicians wearing. The PFDs are designed to deliberately deploy into water and be able to swim and operate in the water with them. A life jacket is designed to keep your head above the water if you enter it. So usually they deploy on contact with the water, although sometimes it's with a bit of a pulley. So if you're a commander or something like that, and you absolutely need to be a little bit closer to the water, then make sure that you've leaned into either the fire service or your heart sort of response for a life jacket.
Okay.
And then after that, we've got the cold air, the cold zone, which is anything beyond that 3 meter area. And this is where you want your kit dump. This is where you want your resource area. If we're going to move patients out of the water, this is where we're going to resuscitate them. So we don't want to be doing it. The temptation is, as soon as you pull them out of the water, everyone floods into that warm zone, into that 3 meter zone, and tries to resuscitate the patients there. We need to invest a little bit and move those patients away from the water's edge and sort of resuscitate them in that nice, safe area where no one's going to fall in. Yeah, and then just one last thing, I guess, really, is there's always going to be more than just the patient in the water. Oh, you've always got to think, there's more than just the victim that's in the water. I've been to several incidents where you've got members of the public climbing on rocks, climbing on the other side of bridges to get a better look of the rescue. All of those people are potential victims. Anyone who's deployed in the water, even with the right kit, is a potential victim. So very, very quickly, these become very resource-heavy jobs. It's one of the few jobs we do where you can't have enough water responders, really, because there's always something we could do to make it safer or to anticipate more victims in the water.
That's great. That's really good. Thanks so much for sharing that inside knowledge on the considerations for the scene management aspect of it. GeoCalc, I know I bang on about GeoCalc a bit too much, but they have like a really good visual aid for some of the stuff that I think you've talked about in terms of like timings as well. I think it's a really good kind of visual cue,
yeah,
in terms of like decision making, management, clinical decision making at these cases. So their little flow diagram starts off with, you know, but they start the case, you know, they figure out, is the patient submerged, yes or no? So if the patient is not submerged, then rescue operations begin. If the patient is submerged, they start the clock. The next step is information gathering. There's things to take into account, which we'll kind of touch on shortly, but body size, water temperature, the last time the patient was seen. They'll kind of also flow down then to, you know, it will be 0 minutes, kind of in inverted commas, a dynamic risk assessment, sort of a go or no go exercises is made, and that will be taken into account, like the things you said, like have we got adequate water safety technicians or sort of SRT trained members of staff there? Are the fire service there? how far away are those specialist operators going to take to get to scene? And then they'll flow down to, you know, if we're going to go for it and we're going to start the rescue process, rescue operations begin. And within that kind of first 30 minutes, I think it's just worth noting, isn't it, that's really, patients that are submerged for less than 10 minutes have a really good chance of outcome. Whereas when we start to go beyond more than about 25 minutes, the chances of a favourable outcome from a cardiac arrest scenario, they're going to diminish rapidly, aren't they? There's a few things that are going to have bearing on that, which we'll talk about. Like I said, we'll get to that whole metabolic ice box conundrum. But I mean, the rescue efforts can go up to 90 minutes, can't they, in some cases?
Yeah, they can. So there's a few things with this, because the tool itself is very, very helpful and the evidence behind it is fantastic. The clock starts from that first response on scene, but we can, as in the first responder that's arrived on scene, we start the 30 minutes from them. But it can be other things as well. So sometimes you've got credible witnesses. So somebody that hasn't left scene, they're a relatively credible person. They're not sort of, there's no issues around their recollection of events, should we say. So they're not intoxicated or anything like that. And they've said the person jumped off the bridge and they went in the water right there and they're pointing right at it. And I've been here the whole time and their head has not come above water. Those credible witnesses can be hard to find because these scenes are really chaotic and people are sort of going backwards and forwards to make phone calls or to meet the emergency services. So it's not always the most reliable way. But there has been jobs that I've been involved in where the police have had access to CCTV, for example, and we've been able to sort of see where the patient's gone in. There's no flow, which generally means the patient doesn't move. They're usually within sort of 2 meters of where they've entered if there's little or no flow. And they're definitely not come back up. So that's allowed us to sort of start that 30-minute mark from there. But I think as clinicians, this is where we've got we have a lot of input here. And that is you just absolutely hit the nail on the head. And that is in warm water conditions. So sort of any water that's above that 6 to 7 degrees, and we don't have sort of large surface area to sort of body ratios like we do with children. Then realistically 30 minutes under the water where there's been no question that you've not been able to come back up or you've popped your head up and you've been going in your head sort of under the water, then above the water and maybe had a bit of swim failure or something, where we know that person's head's been underwater for 30 minutes, then actually the prognosis is really, really poor. And particularly if there's a risk to rescue staff, we don't really want to be sort of going on longer than 30 minutes under those circumstances. Your 60 minutes, it's the opportunity to have that same discussion. So maybe we've gone 60 minutes because there has been a bit of doubt as to whether that patient sort of had their head above water. So they were seen to keep sort of popping up every so often as they were going down river, for example, or they were seen to be holding onto a rock or a branch before they were swept away a little bit later on. Little things like that, where there's some doubt as to how long that person's been their head's been underwater, then we might push it out towards 60 minutes when there's little risk to the rescuers. After 60 minutes, then generally we are looking at body recovery unless we start to move into the special circumstances side of it, which is generally small children jumping into water that's sort of 6 to 7 degrees or less. Now, it's okay saying that. It's really easy to sort of regurgitate that number because it's written down somewhere, but applying that in practice is a lot harder because we often don't know the temperature of the water that the patient's in. So I know myself and sort of fire service colleagues, we tend to go off of if there was, you know, ice frost on the ground or ice in the water, if it's still water, then we'll assume that it's below 6 to 7 degrees. So yeah, frost or ice on the ground, or if it's still water and it's this frozen, you've had to break the ice to get into the patient, which we've done a few of, then we'll always treat it as sort of rapid immersion into icy cold water and maybe push it out a little bit longer towards that 90 minute mark.
That water temperature of less than 5 degrees, should we just explain for those people listening that may not be aware of the kind of physiological preservations behind that? So the hypothermia essentially acts as like a neuroprotection, doesn't it? It reduces the demand for oxygen within the body, and I've heard it being described as the metabolic ice box, essentially. So you're slowing down the body's requirement for oxygen, and thus you're kind of protecting the body really against those secondary injuries, aren't you? Like the tissue death, the secondary brain injuries that may occur as a result of the hypoxic insults. It's going to lessen the effects of those things, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah, you're absolutely right. So for children, for example, that would mean that there's a really good chance that rescue operations are worth spending sort of more time investing in. For adults, less so, but actually sometimes, and I've been involved in a couple of these where has a person sort of drowned and that's what, and then we pulled them out of ice cold water and, you know, that's why they're cold, or have they actually sort of been in the water managing to keep themselves afloat, say, for a while, and eventually succumbed to hypothermia and then gone underwater, in which case, like, I've certainly managed adults under those circumstances where it's a bit vague as a hypothermic arrest, for example. But with children in particular, yeah, it's it gives us a bit more optimism that we can have a favourable outcome, even up to the 90-minute mark if we manage to get them out.
It's the speed of the cooling down process, isn't it, almost? Because you've got, you said the children are going to be more so a benefit to this metabolic icebox conundrum. Females tend to fare better as well as generally thinner people, because if you've got a lot of sort of fatty tissue, it's going to take longer for the body to cool down. And thus, you're not going to become hypothermic as quickly, and then you're not going to get those benefits, are you, of that neuroprotection and metabolic icebox benefits that we spoke about?
No.
Okay, Brill.
Is there anything... I suppose it could be worth talking about sort of a resuscitation point of view and sort of the clinical management when they come out, if you'd like to talk about that.
Yeah, definitely. I think let's start talking about the actual management of these people now. Yeah. We talked about how we're going to get them out and whatnot, but in terms of like cardiac arrest and ALS alterations, we need to consider. Let's touch on that.
Yeah, so I mean, from a resource council point of view, we advocate the 5 rescue breaths, and then after that, it's essentially ALS with hypoxia likely sort of being your primary reversible cause. But if you've got that sort of your bandwidth's maxed out, like I said, it's the first drowning you've ever been to, and you've just defaulted into your ALS algorithm straight away and forgot those 5 rescue breaths, then it's not the end of the world. The important thing is that we are providing active, high quality sort of resuscitation and aggressively addressing that reversible cause of hypoxia. So we want to sort the airway out first, and the airway, unsurprisingly, is going to have fluid in it, and there might be quite a lot, especially if the patient's regurgitating fluid, if they've swallowed quite a lot of it as we're resuscitating.
I didn't realise that there's about 3 to 6 litres, isn't there, of water that the stomach can hold. So they've regurgitated that into the stomach, yes, as well. It's going to be a nightmare to manage some of these airways.
Absolutely. So if your strategy is to, say, put them in a postural drain and hope it's a go away and not be performing effective CPR, then it's not, your resuscitation is not going to work. We still need that high quality uninterrupted sort of CPR ongoing with minimal sort of time off the chest. So suction can really help you, but again, expect if you're getting, you know, 3 to 6 litres of fluid out of someone's abdomen coming up into their sort of oropharynx, that you're going to be suctioning quite a lot. But the important thing is just getting an airway device in there. So something like an eye gel just to get you started is absolutely fine. Yes, it's not going to provide the best protection for the airway, and you are going to encourage a bit of aspiration as you're ventilating, but the lungs probably got a lot of water in there already. The important thing is that we start to ventilate the lungs, get everything opened up again, let all of that fluid start coming out of the lungs, which is what, you know, we often see all those, but like a lot of liquid coming out and a lot of those bubbles, that's a fact. And eventually, whether it's in your scope of practice or whether you've got once an enhanced care team arrive, then intubation can really help from that point onwards. So whilst it can help, it is a really effective intervention. You also then need to anticipate it's probably going to be a bit of a tricky intubation in terms of visualizing the cords with all the stuff that's going on inside the airway. But if we can get a tube in there, then actually that's going to allow us to deliver better ventilation pressures, which can give us a bit of a sort of fighting chance against that decreased lung compliance from the pulmonary edema. And also you get this diaphragmatic splinting where you get a lot of that water that's still in the stomach. Well, obviously with your diaphragm being the main muscle of breathing that would normally flatten and contract down against that sort of stomach. this higher intra-abdominal pressure because of all the liquid that's in there can mean that actually it's not sort of moving as it should. So you get this like sort of splinting effect. So a tube can give us can help us overcome that a little bit. But even with the tubing, you're going to get a lot of surfactant coming up the lungs. So a lot of this like pink bubbles coming up the tube, out of the lungs. Ignore it. You'll spend all day trying to suction it, and often that'll detract from the more important things that we need to be doing, which is that sort of high quality resuscitation. As we sort of go from a ventilation point of view, then hypoxia is likely to be the most likely sort of reversible cause for this arrest. If you've got a post-ROSC patient or a patient that's not in cardiac arrest that you're managing their airway for, then we want to try and aim to get their end-tidal CO2 to sort of normal capnia, so that 4 to 6.5 kilopascals. There's a couple of things that I've picked up from my own practice, though, and that's depending what end-tidal CO2 device you're using, it can become saturated and need replacing if you're using like an inline device. But things like the HME filters, the heat moisture exchange filters that we put into our airway circuits, they can become really, really saturated as well. And if you can imagine, this is like a semi sort of permeable sort of artificial membrane that's in that HME filter. And as that gets wet, it becomes more difficult to breathe through. And it sounds weird, but the only thing I can liken it to is, if you put your T-shirt in front of your mouth and you took a breath, you can breathe through it. If it was wet, you're going to find it more difficult.
Yeah.
The same's true when you're ventilating them with these. So sometimes you might need to replace these HME filters. If you're starting to get like a lot of resistance and you can see it's absolutely sodden, you might just need to put a fresh one on as you're ventilating them. And then the other one with end-tidal CO2 is obviously when it's really low, it can be a useful prognostication tool for cardiac arrests normally. Or it can guide things like, sort of rescuer fatigue with CPR or CPR not being as effective as it could be. Some of these patients, if they're coming out hypothermic, which just by being in relatively cold water for a protracted period of time, they're going to be, that end-tidal CO2 might be really low anyway. So it's not as helpful as a prognostication tool. And then, again, if you're thinking your patient's cold when they've come out, then just default to your GRCALC guidelines with regards to drug dosing in terms of either doubling the dose or doubling the dose intervals or not giving the drugs depending on the temperature. Same again, limiting your defibrillation attempts below 30 degrees.
Yeah.
So I think, from a resuscitation point of view, that's sort of the things that I've either, I'd either consider or I've come across in my own practice that sort of need to adapt.
Yeah, definitely. And I said, just to kind of add a little point that might be worth consideration for those patients that are, like you said, a lot of them are going to be hypothermic, a lot of them are going to have, because of that, they might sort of have reduced chest compliance as well. I think you touched on the provider fatigue in terms of CPR, and if a device such as a Lucas is available and you've got that with the enhanced care teams, it's definitely worth thinking about having some kind of mechanical chest compressions involved, isn't it?
Absolutely, especially if you, like I said, if you are starting to maybe treat it as a hypothermic arrest rather than a drowning, because the two, can be very closely related, then you absolutely want to be setting up for the long haul, get a mechanical CPR device on. If you are going to be transporting this patient to hospital intra arrest, then same again, we know that performing CPR in the back of a moving ambulance, whilst it looks great on casualty, it's not the best thing for the patient. So if we've got a mechanical CPR device so we can just maintain that really good, high quality, effective CPR throughout, then that's absolutely vital.
There was a couple of questions that came in on the Twitter page, and for those of you who aren't already following the Medic in the Middle Twitter page, please do take a look. The Twitter handle is @MedicMiddle. But there was a couple of guys that kind of messaged in and wanted a couple of questions addressing. So Surfing Medicine, who are a really cool Twitter page actually to check out. I hadn't looked at them before a few weeks ago, so go and check those guys out. But they asked about the most common challenges in airway and ventilation management, and I think you've already kind of answered that question beautifully with the spiel you've just done on the difficulties you're going to face with airway management and regurgitation and considerations with end-tidal CO2 and intubation and stuff. So I'm happy that we've kind of addressed that one. Tea and Medals, or John R, kind of got in touch.
Of course he did.
Yeah, he asked, does the salinity of water, so the fresh water versus salt water, have an impact on how quickly someone will drown? So I donated £10 to the RNLI for Paddy Morgan to give me a really good spiel on this. So Paddy Morgan, as I mentioned, is the medical director for the UK Coast Guard. He has quite a lot to do with the RNLI, and he's just a really intelligent chap. I believe he's based down south, isn't he, near Portsmouth. He's one of the anaesthetists down there. So he answered this question beautifully. Does the salinity of water affect the speed of drowning? Effectively, he said no. The bottom line is that the drowning process is ultimately one of hypoxia. So some fluid, irrespective of whether it's hyperosmolar or isotonic or fresh water, salt water, whatever, the water's got into the lungs and it's preventing gaseous exchange. Thus, we're getting this VQ mismatch. So there are quite a few factors which we've already talked about, isn't there, affecting the speed of drowning, water temperature being one of them, concurrent injuries or trauma, the amount of flotation available or the ability to float or swim of the patient or the mechanism. And then you throw in like all these different physiological responses to the processes, which, you know, have a huge variability then, and suddenly the kind of saltiness or the freshness of the water becomes not so relevant. And essentially the bottom line management for ourselves, as we've already mentioned, is that there's no difference pre-hospitally to the management of these patients, whether it's fresh or salt. We've touched on quite a lot, I think. I'm happy we've kind of covered, you know, done a bit of a whistle stop tour of drownings. Unless there's anything else you want to kind of throw into the mix, I think we've touched on quite a lot.
No, I think that's it. And it'd be sort of remiss of me not to just emphasise again your safety and safety of bystanders when you're jumping in. Water is just a lot more dangerous than I ever used to give it credit for. And even really, really strong swimmers can come into complications in the water. So yeah, just please be safe. Think of your safety and sort of you going home at the end of that shift.
And just for those people who have listened, obviously go and give us a follow on Twitter. And I said I'd just kind of give these guys a little plug. So Surfing Medicine's a really good charity, really good guys to check out. The Royal Life Saving Society have got loads of information on water safety and water safety advice and how we can kind of stay safe by water. Obviously the RNLI and the UK Coast Guard do loads of really good work as well, so definitely go and check those guys out. Thanks, Paddy Morgan, for your tips and tricks. And obviously thanks, John, for coming to chat to us on the show. I know you were on shift last night and stuff, and you finished a little bit late, so I really appreciate you coming on and chatting about drownings and in your spare time. It's really, really cool of you. Thank you.
Not a problem at all. Thanks for having me. Yeah, it's been a great experience.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Medic in the Middle, and thanks again to John for joining us on this episode. We hope you've learned lots. As always, as mentioned, please do go and check out our Twitter page at Medic Middle and let us know if there's any topics you would like us to cover next. But for now, take care and see you next time.